Yesterday afternoon, I was explaining the theory of the Yogacara school of Mahayana Buddhism, which has to do with the tree-like design of the production of consciousness. And we went into the similarity between the symbol of the tree and the symbol of the river, where the direction of the tree seems to be from the trunk to the branches, and the direction of the river from the branches to the trunk. There was an aspect of this that I didn't complete, and that I want to complete before we go on, which is to say something more about the stem or the trunk in this theory. Just to refresh your memories, there were these words, kshetra, which means in Sanskrit the field of the senses. In other words, the kshetra is contrasted with the ayatana, which means gate. That is the sense organ itself, the eye. Then there is the field of the eye, what we call in ordinary English the visual field. And so there's likewise the sonic field. Then behind the ayatana is the vijnana, corresponding to each of the five senses. V-I-J-N-A-N-A. That's how it's Romanized, vijnana. And then behind each vijnana corresponding to each sense, there is mano-vijnana, the mind sense, which is the sixth sense, which coordinates all the others. Under the supposition, you see, that all the senses are simply differentiations of one sense, a fundamental kind of touch. Then behind mano-vijnana is manas, which is the mind. Manas having the same root as the word man. And then, to go on, something I didn't cover yesterday. Manas is considered as rooted in the alaya-vijnana. A-L-A-Y-A, again, vijnana. And the word alaya means store. So underneath is the store consciousness. And the nearest thing that we have to this in our Western ideas is Jung's notion of the collective unconscious. Because the alaya vijnana is supposed to be a kind of repository of the seeds of all possibilities of consciousness and life. So as you go into this tree, you stop being individually you at the level of manas. You see, that manas is pretty much what we would call the ego consciousness. Below that, in alaya vijnana, you come to a level of human existence where you can't be said to be the particular you anymore. For example, each one of us shares in common two eyes, one nose, one mouth, two arms, two legs. And at that level, you see, we are not individual, because we all have that in common. Then likewise, when we go further in to things that are not at all under our conscious control, the functioning of the heart, the machinations of the stomach, the shaping of the bones, and all that sort of thing, this goes on at a level of life which we all share as human beings, but we don't control from voluntary power. And so everything like that is in the domain of the alaya vijnana, which you can call the collective. Now, the funny thing is, they say, not if you translate the Sanskrit literally, it isn't the unconscious. Vijnana means conscious. And it's a very curious thing that we have used the word the unconscious as designating the deeper levels of the psyche. Because the disadvantage of this word is that it leaves out of consideration the fact that it is the unconscious that is conscious. In other words, underneath consciousness, is something you're not conscious of, true. But it is what enables you to be conscious. Nobody knows how he manages to be conscious. You can be conscious of all sorts of things, and you suddenly find yourself doing this, that, and the other, and knowing this, understanding that. But how the devil do you do it? You don't know. And this is one of the weirdest things. If you sit down to contemplate it, think it out, how do you manage to be you? And so we get this funny sense of self-estrangement represented in the common notion that what I really am is a soul which has been given a body and all sorts of capacities. I've been given intelligence, I've been given the power of consciousness, etc. But I am not any of these things. I'm the recipient of these gifts. And this has become, you see, for Western man, a kind of common sense embedded in language. As when we say, I have a body, my mind, you know, as if it was something, kind of engine that I possessed. So it goes back, you see, to the whole notion that most of us, our body, our unconscious, our various powers of will and so on, are given to us by a God who has created them and understands how they work. And you're put in charge of them and you're responsible for them for the time being. So you see, when you think that way, you don't feel responsible for or one with your full organism. And insofar as you don't feel at one with your organism, very naturally, you don't feel at one with everything else. But this is simply a way of figuring life. You don't have to figure it that way. And the advantage of figuring it this way has been, of course, to develop this strong Western sense of the value of the individual person. And this indeed has in it, you see, something very great and fascinating. Just as in the same way, the Westerners developed a sense of interpreting nature as a mechanism and thinking about nature and about all living beings as machines, was the essential step necessary for the production of our technology. This was Newton, this was Descartes, this was their idea of the world as a mechanical system, more or less based on the game of billiards, where atoms are balls which knock each other around and obey certain laws. Now, you understand those laws, you analyze, you understand everything by taking it apart. Now, this is something, you see, that mankind had not really done before. Take it apart and see how it works. Then, when you understand that, you can develop surgery. You can develop microbiology, etc., etc. But then, having done that, you come to another stage where you realize that the mechanical image of nature is not adequate. And you drop it. And you go on, say, to an organic or a quantum-like image. And so the mechanical stage of thinking about the world becomes what de Chardin calls a peduncle. That is a junction system which disappears when you've gone over it. A stalk which is required to pass from one situation to another. But when you've used the stalk, it dries up and vanishes. That's a peduncle. And so in this way, the Western mechanistic view of the world is the peduncle that leads us into our high technological civilization. But in this high technological civilization, we have to realize that the organic model of nature is in the long run more effective than the mechanical model. The Chinese always had the organic model of nature, and therefore they didn't develop a technology in our sense, because they never thought about understanding things by taking them to bits. They understand things by seeing them in context, which is the exact opposite approach to analysis. In analysis, you take any thing and you reduce it to smaller things to understand how it works. But in a context or organic way of thinking, you understand a given thing not by taking it apart, but by considering its relationships to all the other things around it. See? So, the West, having developed analysis to such a fine degree of perfection, then discovers that that's not the whole story. That you may press analysis a long, long way, but then you have to retract yourself and consider what things are in context. And therefore, the Chinese way of thinking becomes relevant to a scientific technological culture. Now, these are two ways of motion. Well, now, let me go back. The Alaya Vijnana, or store consciousness, which I called the collective unconscious, is therefore the level of ourselves at which we are not individual, where we can say we are just human. And beneath Alaya Vijnana, there's still another which they call Amala, A-M-A-L-A, which means taintless. I don't know that really this word taint in English is quite adequate. Maybe if you call it tint rather than taint is better, without a tint in it. Because, you see, the mirror itself has no color. And this is pure. But, you see, the trouble is when we use the notion of purity in our kind of religious background, we mean sexless. And we've forgotten that the original notion of purity, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, has nothing to do with having no sexual desires. It means clarity. It means pure like clear water, like a clean window, like a crystal. And so, a pure-mindedness is simply clear-mindedness. But, you see, a clear mind is one that isn't hung up on something. When you consider, say, a crystal, if it is not clear, it's distorted. It has a flaw in it. So that when you look through glass that has a flaw in it, you see something happens to the landscape every time it goes by. You see? It suddenly goes bloop like this. And so you notice the glass is there too much. Now, the reason why God is invisible is that God has no flaw. Do you see that? And therefore doesn't appear. It's total transparency, in other words, that does not make any difference to anything at all. So the poem in Zen says, entering the forest, he does not bend a blade of grass. Entering the water, he does not make a ripple. And the track of the wise is described as the track of birds in the sky. They leave no contrail. Actually, they do. It can be photographed with infrared cameras, but so far as you'd know, they don't leave any traces. So, purity, the pure mind, means the one where you finally get down to its making no difference to anything at all. And this, then, from one point of view, is the most unimportant mind that you have. Because it doesn't make a difference. But from another point of view, it is the most important. Because without that, you wouldn't have anything. Now, here comes one of the most fantastic philosophical problems of today. There has been a development in Western philosophy which we call by several names: scientific empiricism, logical positivism, logical analysis. And this is the prevailing philosophical school in the Anglo-Saxon world. It completely captured Cambridge, then Oxford, then most American universities. And you will find almost all serious philosophical practitioners today belong to this school. Now, logical positivism completely demolishes any kind of interest in metaphysics by saying not that metaphysical statements are untrue, but that they're meaningless. That is to say, any proposition which says, for example, all things are the will of God contains no information whatsoever. Because whatever you state about everything is a statement which is a tautology. That means it is simply saying everything is everything, only you've said it in another way. So this is a very powerful critique of the whole past history of philosophy, that it was all meaningless. People were hung up on words and were fighting with words and purely verbal problems. And so that you can only talk meaningfully about things that can be said. That is to say, you can only talk about whatever is classifiable. If, in other words, a certain experience, a sensation, is not differentiable from any other one, you can't talk about it. The thing to be manifest, to be definable, to be describable, to be experienced at all, has to have a boundary. And so you can see what is inside the boundary and differentiate it from what is outside. And so these philosophers are arguing that you can only describe what has boundaries. This is their fundamental assumption. And of course, in a way, that's quite true. But the difficulty is that this has reduced philosophy to an extremely pedestrian pursuit. The professional academic philosopher in the United States or in England today has condemned himself to a kind of wonderless attitude. The ancient philosopher, you see, lies awake at night wondering about the meaning of existence. The modern philosopher would find that would be extremely unscholarly to do anything like that, because he must realize that when you wonder about the nature of being, you are simply suffering from an intellectual neurosis. You're out of order. Your logic has all gone wrong and you've become bugged with words. And in a way, you have. He's quite right up to a point. But then on the other hand, you see, when you study the relationship of categories to each other, and you see that every inside has to have an outside, then you begin to suspect that there's something in common between insides and outsides. They always go together. Now, what is it that they have in common? Well, then you see very soon that there is no word for that, because it's not a class. It's like a glass instead of a class. In other words, it is the transparent medium in which it all happens, in the same way as all sight, all shapes and colors are in the medium of optics, or all bodies are in the medium of space. So we come to something which doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference, and yet it is fundamentally important. Now, this notion, you see, of there being something fundamentally important which makes no difference at all to anything is a very subtle idea that has to be absorbed by Western philosophy if it is to redeem itself from being totally boring. And I will illustrate it in this way. I want to illustrate it by the image of the usefulness of useless things. This goes by analogy, you see, with the tremendous importance of that which doesn't make any difference at all. Useless, see? Well, now, we often say that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. In other words, if you don't spend any time wasting time doing useless things, you will not be healthy. And so in this country, where we have a very utilitarian aspect of things, we are above all practical people. We only allow people to be in a playful state if we are quite sure that it will improve them. And for this reason, we never really succeed in playing. We always justify it. You go to the concert because it is good for you, you know. There's wives who have a great idea that about the opera and the concert, drag their husbands out, and who are totally bored by the whole thing, but they feel somehow or other that this is culture and is, you know. Now, so in the same way, it is very important, but you must not make it important, you see, to have, along with one's ordinary, regulated, everyday life, which is practical and conducive to survival and all that, you must have a certain amount of insanity in your life. That's the real reason for having Sunday. Every seventh day is a day off. And it's a day off from making sense. I have to make sense all the time, you see? I'm making sense to you now. But sometimes I would like just to go instead. Because I need to loosen up my intellect. I call it to randomize the intellect. Actually, before I ever give a lecture, instead of sitting down carefully and thinking out what I'm going to say, I randomize my intellect completely and let everything be forgotten and then start. Because this limbers you. It's just like a person who was going to do something like surgery could do this with his fingers first to feel that everything is working, you see. Well, this doesn't make any sense at all. This is just motion. But he's got himself limbered, you see, and he's ready then to do something very precise. So in the same way, a steel bridge has to be limber. It has to give and sway in the wind, otherwise it'd crack. The slightest earthquake or storm would knock it down. And so with people. People have to be limber to be sane. And therefore, every seventh day, you should go crazy. And at least once a day, in every 24 hours, you know, there should be a crazy time for complete limbering up of the mind. Now, this kind of crazy time has been handled by human beings in very many different ways. Many, what we think today are religious rites, are actually crazy. They've acquired, you see, an air of solemnity because people forgot what they were really about. And the parents said to the children, you ought to do this thing, it's good for you. And the children said, oh, no, you know, because the parents said, you ought to do it. It's good for you. And so the children, over many generations, did these things because they felt it was good for them and therefore got all the wrong spirit into it. And so for this reason, then, you go into a church, whether it is Buddhist or Christian, it doesn't matter what it is, and everybody's going like this, and looking as if this was desperately serious. This is a complete reversal. Now, one of the things that is coming into being now, today, is a new religious spirit, which is non-serious religion. One of the great exponents of this is a man called James Broughton, who is a local poet. And he has written the most fantastically amusing poems about religion. And the funny thing about his attitude is that it is respectful serious all at once, but not. In other words, it is a kind of religious humor. I'll play some to you this afternoon. But he has this wonderful double take where he is really respecting religion. He's a very religious man. But he treats it in this light touch. I remember when I was a priest, I still have this attitude because it's been with me for many, many years. And we used to have a great, gorgeous service in the Episcopal Church in Northwestern, where, of course, because this thing is essentially joyous, we had candles and vestments and incense and the works, you know. And I remember I had a special student who was called the Sorcerer's Apprentice. And he always carried the incense, see? And I remember one day we arrived at the altar. You know, the service was beginning, the organ was going full blast, the choir was singing, and in this very solemn way we arrived at the altar and made the profound bow, you know, which you make because you're in the presence of God. And we both started laughing. Because it was just delightful, you see? The thing was swinging. And you see, this really is the religious attitude. People who are not initiates think it's irreverent. You're not laughing at the deity and saying, oh, you old so-and-so. Well, you might be just a little bit, but the deity appreciates this, you see. What you're doing is you are limbering your mind. You're letting it all go, you see, whammo. Because if you do that, then you've got something to work with later. But you mustn't do it with later in mind. You see? Then you're not doing it. And so this is the meaning that in a meditation exercise, in a religious exercise, take no thought for the morrow. You see? Because then, so long as you have got the notion in mind that this religious exercise is going to be useful and is going to come out practical, that is to say, help you to survive, you haven't let go. And therefore, just so long as you don't let go, your survival chances go down. Care killed the cat. On the other hand, watch and pray. You know, be on your guard. All those Christian hymns about brethren, be sober, be vigilant. Your adversary, the devil, is a walking, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour, whom resist steadfast in the faith. And so at the office of Compline, which is said at the end of the day, they have a hymn which asks God to protect one during the night, because you're going to go to sleep and you're going to be unconscious, and therefore anything might happen. You see? So, please God, watch over us that we don't have any naughty thoughts in the night and all that sort of thing. See? So the devil may get you while you're asleep. So always, Christian, dost thou see them on the holy ground, how the powers of darkness prowl and prowl around. Christian, up and smite them, you know? So this attitude, you see, on guard. Always.
like this. Eh? Well, that's all right, you know. You have to be. Life is requires work and effort and all sorts of things like that. But you mustn't have it all the time. You've got to take time off from that. And the secret of that is, you see, once you really get into the secret of taking time off from being on guard, then you can eventually get into the deeper secret that being on guard, too, isn't serious. That, too, is play. Only the moment I've said it, that too is play, I seem to have abolished any distinction between play and seriousness. In which case, if I've done that, play doesn't mean anything anymore. From the logical point of view. But do you see? Do you see that underneath all logical distinctions, where we say, well, it's either this or that, there is something in common between them. Now, I said that thing in common, let's go back, you're quite clear about this. I said, I was going to explain the thing that lies in common and that is of no importance because it makes no difference by the image of the useless and how important the useless things in life are. So in this way, we would say then, basically the universe has no purpose, isn't serious, is just, you go out and look at the trees, and the trees are doing this and this and this and this, and having seeds and more trees coming along, and so on. So we'll be doing. And we would say, well, should I take some sort of attitude to this? Well, let's do it. But it isn't serious. It's what's called in Mahayana Buddhism, that aspect of things, is called the Sambhogakaya. Sambhoga, S-A-M-B-O-G-H-A. Wait a minute. B-H-O-G-A. Bhoga means bliss, enjoyment, delight. Sambhoga means complete delight. Sam means us, like the Latin summa and the English sum. Total delight body. So, in what is called the Trikaya, T-R-I-K-A-Y-A, the three bodies of Buddha, you have the Dharmakaya, which is the undifferentiated ground, which nobody can say anything about. Opposite, Nirmanakaya, which is everything you're looking at. And the joint between them is Sambhogakaya, that all this which seems to matter and to be differentiated and to make sense is jazz. It comes out of Dharmakaya for no reason whatsoever, just for kicks. It's all useless from the point of view of what we call being practical. Because the practical point of view is simply confined to what cuts and distinctions you can make. So all practical people are precise people. They want to know precisely what and if and so on. How unpleasant to meet Mr. Elliot with his features of clerical cut, and his brow so grim, and his mouth so prim, and his conversation so nicely restricted to what precisely, and if, and perhaps, and but. So, yeah, you know, that has its place. But
there's something else too, underneath all those distinctions. And the balanced human being lives in both worlds. He makes sense, but also he makes nonsense.